sometime this coming week. Unless the Reagan administration withdraws its proposal, the Senate of the United States will vote to approve or disapprove an $8.5 billion arms sale agreement with the government of Saudi Arabia. The House of Representatives has already overwhelmingly voted to disapprove that sale. And so the vote in the Senate has a degree of authority and finality to it. And as you know, there has been frenetic lobbying, great media concern about the vote over these past weeks. Both proponents and opponents of the measure have told us that there will be cataclysmic consequences if their particular position is not affirmed. I confess that I cannot see this decision as having that kind of serious consequence. I don't think it will change much of that exists, the tensions, the realities, of the Middle East. I look upon this contest, this decision rather, as one of a number of ongoing confrontations between the administration and the Congress, between any administration and any Congress, over the control of the decision-making process in the area of foreign affairs. We are coming off of a period in which the Congress has asserted a certain degree of authority in this area against the imperial presidencies of Mr. Kennedy, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Nixon. And this is another one of those, as I see it, tests of force, tests of authority between the legislative and the administrative branches of the government. And in that seesaw continuing battle, this decision will have some consequence. It will either say that the Congress will continue to have a major voice in certain areas, particularly the area of military sales and procurement, foreign aid, or it will say that the administration, this administration at least, has for the moment at least, almost decisive authority in these areas. I think, in other words, that the lobbying, the media buildup, the concern which has been shown is to a certain degree out of proportion to the real issues that are involved. If the agreement to the sale is reached, and over the next several years, the five AWACS planes, which are its central feature but not its only feature, are sent on and added to the Saudi arsenal, the Saudis will not be at the end of their equipment any better prepared to deal with an external attack from Iraq or Iran or Yemen or even from the Soviets than they would have been otherwise. The AWACS planes are in the air at this very moment over Saudi Arabia. This administration has given a blanket statement of our willingness to defend the Saudis at any cost to us if they are attacked. And that statement by President Reagan just 3 weeks ago is backed by that ultimate authority of international arrangements, that is, that it is in our own national interest to do so. We cannot afford to, the West cannot afford not to have the several millions of barrels a day of oil which have come into the West, onto the Western markets. And we certainly cannot afford to have one quarter of the Earth's known oil reserves falling into enemy hands. And so the Saudis could rest confident that this administration means what it says. The planes are there, and little will change on the site by the sale, by this particular sale. If the sale is defeated, and it appears that it may in fact be defeated, the Saudis will not be weakened in any way. For the truth is that they will be able to purchase equivalent equipment on the open market, We live in a world where if you have money, you can purchase anything from atomic weapons to AWACS planes. The British have already indicated to the Saudi government that if this particular arm package fails to go through, they will have ready to sail to the Saudi Air Force a plane known as the Nimrod, which is roughly the equivalent of the spy plane, the communication center, and the control craft, which the AWACS represents. And so, whether the sale is approved or disapproved, the situation as far as the security of the Saudis will not be measurably affected. And if you doubt that any weapon that you wish to procure can be procured on the open market, I hope you have been following the disclosures of recent days about the arm purchase ability of the Libyan government. This rogue government, which has sponsored terrorism around the world, which we thought was equipped by and trained by Eastern Bloc technicians and Eastern Bloc armaments, we now discover to be receiving through various channels large amounts of Western military equipment, and to have its military, to a very large degree, trained by and equipped by those who come out of our own military and intelligence establishment. In point of fact, in recent days, we have discovered that not only are Westerners, British, French, and Americans training the Libyans in the use of arms and the use of very sophisticated equipment, but apparently many of them were involved in the invasion of Chad, the African nation to Libya's north, and have been engaged in what would be equivalent to actual operations on behalf of this rogue government. If the sale fails to go through, the Israeli government and the Israeli military position will not be markedly improved, because the Nimrods and the other equipment will be there. If it goes through, the Israeli position will not be markedly weakened, because at least in the short term, the United States will feel necessary to maintain at least the posture of even-handedness, to sell some jamming equipment and other kinds of equipment to the Israelis. And in any case, given the world as it is, once technology has been developed, technology will pour into those areas, military technology, where it is wanted, and each action by one side requires a counteraction by the other. You can't keep today atomic weaponry, AWACS planes, whatever, out of the conflicts of the world. And finally, and I think most importantly for us to remember, if the sale is defeated, the relationships between our own government and the Saudi government, or rather between our own government and Saudi oil and business contracts, will not change. Despite the shadows that are being predicted, the crises that are being predicted by those who are trying to sponsor the sale, it's a simple truth. That neither Saudi self-interest nor American self-interest will permit the rupture of this relationship. We require Saudi oil, the recycling of the petrodollars. The Saudis require our technicians, our equipment, our manpower. Saudi Arabia, when all is said and done, is a country in search of a population. Saudi Arabia is not defended by Saudi Arabians in any significant sense. It is defended by the West. There are 40,000 American technicians, equipment specialists, and officers in Saudi Arabia today. The entire plan for the rearming of the Saudi government, the Saudi military, was drawn up by the Pentagon. And in addition to the 40,000 Americans, many of whom are not only in our active military, but are in other departments of our government who are building up the Saudi army and the Saudi infrastructure, the roads, the electricity, the airports, the ports, which are required for a modern military power, there are an equal number of English, French, and West Germans, 80,000 from the West in all, who are essentially the Hessians, the mercenaries, the men, the manpower, which makes whatever effect the Saudi military may have effective. So the Saudis cannot live without us, and we cannot, we think, live without them. And so very little will change on the site, whatever be the decision taken by the Senate next week. Let me step back for a moment because I think it's important for all of us to recognize the background of this issue and what is really being talked about. The present Saudi government represents the ascension of a group of once nomadic tribes called the Al Saudis, who came into power in the central areas of this vast subcontinent in the latter part of the 19th century. Saudi Arabia is a country three times the size of modern France. Only 1% of the Saudi Arabian territory is arable, cultivable. And the large interior areas and most of the coastlands have traditionally been governed by fiercely independent tribes whose only bond of contact was the fact they shared the Muslim faith and that there were temporary truces of God during the Hajira, during the time when they made Hajj, when they made pilgrimages to Mecca, to the holy place, which is in Hejaz, on the Red Sea, in the western area of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. In the middle of the 19th century, because of the increasing contact of Arabians, of these Muslims with foreigners, particularly the British and the French, there developed among some of these tribes a form of Muslim revivalism, a kind of Calvinist Muslim position known as Wahhabi. And the Al Saudis, these military, paramilitary tribal chiefs, made common cause with this evangelistic and pietistic Wahhabi Muslim approach. And this allowed them to create an institution called the Fellowship, which allowed the Arabs for the first time to come together, transcending these narrow tribal loyalties. And they created the Ifwan, which is a sense of fellowship, a military fellowship from various tribes, people who came together, drawn together by the love of booty, by the love of conquest, and by the Wahhabi missionary zeal. And over a period of 30 or 40 years, and with much bloodshed, this Al Saudi-led military fellowship established effective control over most of the subcontinent. And then in the 1920s, they felt strong enough to move down to the settled areas in the Hejaz, where Mecca and Medina exist, and they overran those cities, and they gained effective control over that part of the world. But then the military fellowship fell to fighting among itself. The tribal traditions reasserted themselves. And though the Al Saudis were able, by the late 1920s, to reestablish their authority, they never forgot the fact that they cannot trust their own, that the tribal relationships are still powerful. And so even today, there are two, not one, but two Arab-Saudi armies. There is the so-called National Army, which is centered in five great military centers around the country. It has the tanks. And there is the National Guard, another army, which is centered in the cities, and it has the anti-tank equipment. And these two groups are constantly played off against each other. And even today, when these two groups are equipped with the most modern of weapons, and when we're talking about the repelling of an enemy attack, and even of a repelling of a Soviet attack, the numbers are so minuscule that it makes this whole issue almost one of that's laughable. They estimate that there are between 30 and 45,000 Saudis in the regular army. And the Institute for Strategic Services in London, which is the most prestigious of all the public intelligence agencies, opts for the lower number. But there's about 30,000 men in the Saudi Arabian army. And there are between 15 and 30,000 men in the Saudi Arabian National Guard. And again, the Institute for Strategic Studies in London opts for the lower of these two figures. Combine these two figures, an army now which is played off one against the other, an army against the National Guard, and you have 45 to 60,000 men under arms. That's the entire Saudi army. Now, there's no chance, really, for the Saudis to build up this army of theirs in a major way. There is no known public census of the indigenous population of Arabia. Or rather, there is a census, but it is a state secret, guarded and known only to the royal family. The census seems to, which seemed to indicate, our intelligence sources tell us, that there are, that there may be 4 million indigenous people in Saudi Arabia. 4 million. Half of these, at least, are women. And that's a matter of moment when one talks about manpower, human power resource in that part of the world. Because the women are kept in purdah, they're kept aside. Only 40,000 women in all of Saudi Arabia are gainfully employed outside of domestic service. And these women are employed only in activities which relate to other women. They are teachers in girls' schools. They are nurses in women's wards. They deal in areas, in shops, in areas where only women purchase goods. They're very limited as to what they can do. And when a Saudi woman is allowed to go abroad for an education, she is not allowed to enroll in the School of Economics, in the School of Government, or in the School of Business Administration. She's not allowed to train herself in any of the so-called man's work or man's world activity. And so there are maybe 2 million Saudis who are male, and that includes the most recently born infant and the aged. Of these 2 million indigenous Saudis, 10% are Bedouin, who are still roaming the vastness of the desert, which is the largest part of the subcontinent. Two-thirds are illiterate or semi-literate, either because they're too young or grew up before the present intensive educational programs were undertaken. And so, brutally, clearly, the manpower resource of Saudi Arabia is inadequate to deal with the economic, political, social, and military infrastructure and structures which are being created. The result has been that the Saudis have had to import their manpower. There are now approximately 8 million people in the country, but almost all whom they've imported are non-Saudis. They owe their interest, they are cultured by other traditions. They come from the West, when you deal with the highest levels of technology. They come from South Korea, from Sri Lanka, from Bengal, from the Philippines, when you deal with manpower which is working on the roads and doing the heavy labor. They come from Egypt, among Palestinians, among Syrians and Iraqis, when you talk of the middle level of the bureaucracy. And these four million workers, employees, mercenaries who have been brought in, obviously have other interests, bring in other ideas, have other political attitudes and political concerns. And this is particularly important when you deal with the Northern Arabs who have come into the country. 67% of the teachers in junior high schools in Saudi Arabia are either Egyptians or Palestinians. 87% of all the teachers in the high schools are either Palestinians or Egyptians. And 100% of all the teachers in the non-yeshivot, the non-Quranic schools, are either Westerners, Palestinians, or Egyptians. Now, these people have other philosophies than that puritanical, feudal, autocratic philosophy, which is that of the ruling class, the feudal aristocracy of Saudi Arabia. And obviously, covertly, subtly, they are transmitting a great deal of their concerns and their interests and their philosophies to their Saudi students. The Saudi government made no attempt to modernize its military, really, until the 1960s. And when it did so, its concern was not Israel. Its concern was pan-Arabism. This was the era of Nasser. And General Nasser, you remember, fomented a revolution in that southern area of Arabia, which is called Yemen. And a Democratic Republic of Yemen emerged, which was revolutionary in its philosophy. A republic, by the way, whose army equals in numbers the army of the Saudis. And in Saudi Arabia itself, both among the Syrian, the Palestinian, and the Egyptian technical class who had been brought into the country, and among a small number of Saudis in the military, in the lower ranks of the military, who were not aristocrats, that is, not members of the Al-Saudi group, A Nasserite idea spread rapidly. There was a rebellion in the Air Force in 1969, which effectively grounded the entire Air Force of the Saudis. There were rebellions in a number of the cities, which were quickly suppressed. Fearful of the Democratic Republic of Yemen, fearful of Nasser's Egyptian army, the Saudis turned to the West for technicians, for experts, and for equipment. And this was precisely the time when the British had decided to retreat from east of Suez, and when Mr. Nixon and his administration proclaimed the doctrine that we would find elsewhere in the world surrogate governments who could be the military force and replace our troops wherever they existed. And so we went into a period in which Iran and Saudi Arabia were seen to be as the forces which would stabilize the Middle East as far as the oil-producing areas were concerned, and we began pouring equipment, technicians, manpower into these countries. It was a very happy solution. Alone among the underdeveloped parts of the world that were still not within the Soviet orbit, Iran and Saudi Arabia could pay for the equipment that we were sending in. Our military-industrial complex was delighted with the contracts that they were receiving. Our military was delighted to be able to use its skills and to teach its skills to others. And in 1972, 1974, and 1976, the Pentagon and the CIA and our other government agencies developed for the Saudis major two, 3, and 5-year plans, which were designed at great cost to the Saudis to develop for them a modern air force, a modern navy, and to modernize their army and their national guard. By 1978, intelligence reports coming back to the West began to use a term describing the what was happening in Saudi Arabia, and the term was saturation. You may recall that in 1978, the Carter administration proposed to the Congress another multi-billion dollar Saudi equipment, arms equipment bill, whose major feature was sending to them 60 F-15s, the latest fighter and fighter bomber in our Air Force. And the opposition to the sale at that time was very much as it is today, that the Saudis might be able to use these arms against Israel, our staunch ally in that part of the world, and more importantly, that they lacked the pilots, they lacked the skills to fly, to maintain the arms that we were giving them. The Carter administration's response was very much like that of the Reagan administration. There would be guarantees that the planes would not be equipped so that they could fly all the way to Israel and back. The extra bomb racks and the extra wing tanks were not sent along with the planes, and we would send sufficient technicians and sufficient manpower to see that these planes were in fact constantly operable. In 1979, it became clear that despite our assertions and our promises, we were not able to keep the equipment which had already been sent to the Saudis in operation. You may recall in 1979, a small group estimated between 300 and 500 desert Saudis occupied the great shrine at Mecca and held off the Saudi National Guard for a number of days. During that period of time, the Yemenis mobilized their army on the Saudis' southwestern border, and the National Guard was rushed to the border, or they wanted to rush the National Guard to the border in order to defend it. They found that they were unable to move their National Guard, despite the fact it had the most advanced English Rover armor personnel carriers in the world. It had lacked sufficient number of men equipped to drive these armored rovers, and those that where there were enough drivers, the equipment was not serviced and it was inoperable. And if they can't operate a truck or an armored carrier, how can they operate the most sophisticated aircraft in the world? And so, what we have is a condition where a small country is being asked to undertake a military expansion far beyond its capacity to maintain in anything but cost, and where it is being asked to, it is demanding equipment because it likes the most advanced playthings. It's an aristocratic country, which it really has no way of handling. That's the problem. If saturation existed in 1978, imagine what exists when you talk about the new equipment in this $8.5 billion new program which is being proposed. The Saudis have more equipment than they have skilled personnel on a one-for-one basis. And the very skilled pilots required must all come from the Saudis, that is, from the small aristocratic upper class who insists that this is, they want to be the flying cowboys, there's macho involved in all of this, no one else may go into the cockpits. And so in point of fact, the reality is that if it weren't for the 80,000 Western technicians who I'm confident are often operating these planes in the air and operating the communications equipment on the ground, the Saudis would find that all this equipment would be stalled, inoperative, and useless within a very short period of time. If it were not so serious an issue, one would wonder at the seichel of our administration, of our Pentagon, of our diplomats, of the Saudis themselves in terms of their approach. But the Saudis are a feudal aristocracy, and they have money, and lots of it. And they have a paranoia about guns. They've always lived by the gun, and they want the best. And by God, we can afford it. And if the Westerners are stupid enough to be willing to send it to us and to send us along the Hessians and the mercenaries who will fly these things and keep them going for us, so much the better, we can afford it. There's a serious question whether they, in fact, can afford it. The present building up of the infrastructure and the equipment of the Saudis have cost them over $200 billion in the last 5 years, and the estimates it will cost them $391 billion in the next 4 years. And if you wonder at the reason that the Saudi oil exports are kept up at the 9 or $10 million barrel per day level, it's because if they fall below that level at current market prices, they will not be able to support the development projects which they have now in the works. The idea that the Saudis can make a major contribution to the defense of the oil fields is laughable. They haven't the manpower. The Iraqi army, which sits to the north, is 5 to 7 times the size of the Saudi army. The Jordanian army, which sits to the west and to the north, is 3 times the size of the Saudi army. The Syrian army, which sits to the north and to the west, is 5 times the size of the Saudi army. And these are armies which are fairly effective, well-trained, and not dependent upon foreign nationals. Indeed, they are armies whose own citizens now sit in places of power within the Saudi army itself. And that's one of the major concerns of many who are voting against this arms sale. Not only that there might be a repetition of what took place in Iran, where some of the latest American electronic and communications equipment fell quickly into the hands of a rebel government, which took over from that of the king, but that it would be very simple for the Palestinians, the 350,000 Palestinians who are part of the bureaucratic and technocratic and military infrastructure, or the 175,000 Egyptians who are in similar positions, simply to walk away with the blueprints or walk away with the planes, or fly away with the planes themselves. The security of our own military establishment is a matter of concern. What I've been suggesting throughout this approach is that the issue is not an Israel-Arab issue. Point of fact, I think that the existence of the so-called Israel lobby, if there be such, has played in this connection a major constructive role in a very important domestic political debate. Because there was sufficient concern about Israel and to cause a number of senators, a number of people who are not predisposed to support Israel in all things or in many things, Senator Hatfield of Oregon comes immediately to mind, to look hard at this issue and to recognize that ultimately the only defense of this whole program is that it is a way of supporting those 140 American corporations who are now involved in the selling of electronic equipment, of military equipment around the world. No other grounds can this sale be defended. It will not support the Saudis in any way, that not give them a strength they lack otherwise. The oil lands which they control will be defended if they are defended by the American fleet, by American troops that can be transported into the area. That's the only way they ultimately can be defended. And the existence of this armament poured into a land where it can be easily transported someplace else for whatever purposes is a destabilizing influence throughout the Middle East. On the one hand, the Saudis are so weak that they must pay hundreds of millions of dollars a year in blackmail to the Palestine Liberation Organization, which is a group of terrorists. On the other hand, we speak almost in the same breath. The administration speaks of the Saudis as a major force to prevent the Soviet Union from moving down and taking over the oil fields. It's laughable. The Saudis cannot maintain their own security from subversion with any confidence, and somehow they are going to sustain the West from Soviet movements south towards the ports and towards the oil lands. If it is, in fact, in the national interest to protect Saudi Arabian oil fields from our enemies, we'll have to do it ourselves. That's a decision, a very difficult decision, the administration, others will have to make. But to go about it this way is to delude oneself as to what's involved. Our government, recognizing this, has argued that we need to keep up the ties of friendship with a moderate Arab state, implying that somehow the Saudis are a force for moderation in the Middle East and in the interest of our own interests. That was the position taken by the Carter administration to defend the 1978 sale of the 60 F-15 planes. And the results of that are clear. After 1978, after the sale, we had the Camp David Accords, and the Saudis sabotaged as best they could the Camp David Accords. They put pressure on Jordan not to enter. They decried the report, the accords, in every way they could. They increased their contributions to the Palestine Liberation Organization, and they organized an economic boycott of Egypt. Now, if we're buying friendship, there ought to be a quid pro quo. And there's no evidence that we can buy that friendship. In point of fact, the Saudis are so weak that they cannot alienate any of the radical forces within the Arab world. They are few, and the masses of the Arab world are many. They sit on wealth, and the masses in the Arab world are poor. And they know that they have to buy off the masses. They can't afford to stand against them. And masses, illiterate masses of people any place in the world, are easily inflamed. At issue, I believe, in this contest is not the stability of the Middle East, not the security of the Saudis, not even really the profits of our industrial military corporations, but rather the ability of the United States to free its own foreign policy from the veto of a small group of Arab sheikhs. I'll give the present administration credit for one accomplishment. Under the vacillation of the last years of the Carter administration, we allowed the Saudis to veto a program to put into the ground a strategic oil reserve. The Saudis said to us, we want to be able to control oil production. We want to have the boycott power. And so we won't allow you to put into these caves that you've cut into the salt flats in the West millions of barrels of oil in reserve against a cutoff of our oil deliveries. And believe it or not, the Carter administration succumbed. And we stopped almost at the beginning, the pushing of these stockpiling of the oil reserve, which we require for our economy and for our defense. The Carter administration agreed with the Saudis that we would not publish or make known, even to the departments of our own government, the extent of Saudi economic activity in the United States, even though the billions of petrodollars being sent over here for investment, if they were suddenly pulled back, might destabilize and do terrible things to our economy. Our own government could not discover, because our own government was too cowardly to stand up against the Saudis could not discover where the investments was, the magnitude of the investments, the consequences, and therefore make plans as to the consequences if these investments were withdrawn. And finally, every time the Saudis have demanded arms, even though we know they cannot use these arms, they cannot be possibly be put to useful use, we have kowtowed, bowed our heads, and agreed. What is at issue here is the independence of our own policy from the oil barons of the world. That's the only real issue that's involved. And the reason I believe that a majority of the Senate will this week, if the issue is submitted to them finally, vote to disallow the arms sale. And when they do, it will not be because American Jews have mounted a powerful propaganda lobby. It will not be because Israel's defenses will be weakened. It will be because of the recognition of what the reality is in the Middle East, what the Saudi government really is and is not, its weakness, not its strength, and because of the recognition that we have to have if we are to assert ourselves in the world and play our legitimate role as a major power in the world, we have to have independence to act in our own best interest. We cannot simply be told by a sheikh who has billions of dollars, I want AWAC, I want atomic weapons, I want laser beams, I want the latest wrinkle. They are incapable of using them, their ability to use them is questionable, and the final disposition of these weapons remains a matter of grave concern. We live in a cruel world. We face difficult decisions. But the truth about the Saudis, at least in the Middle East, is that they are weak, not strong. They're underpopulated. They cannot for long really protect the booty on which the oil on which they sit. They are protected now by others, by us, by Western Europe, by Northern Arabs, by Asians. But every one of the mercenaries who are there, and I include the United States as among the mercenaries, every mercenary group is there, has its own purpose in being there, and it's not identical with the Saudi purpose. And ultimately, as the billions of dollars pour in, as the changes take place in society, the dislocations which are inevitable, the Saudi situation will become a more and more complex, roiling, convulsed one, just in terms of its own domestic dimensions. Ultimately, the country will be revealed, I think, to everyone to be a small, weak piece of geography in search of a population that it really is. Saudi Arabia is not a nation. It's a country of a few million people sitting on oil, whose wealth knows that it cannot stay in power. That's why it's investing so much of that wealth abroad. Involved in all kinds of development projects, some well-conceived, some ill-conceived, which presumably will bring it into the 20th century, but it's burdened by a philosophy, burdened by a religion, which is medieval, and burdened ultimately by its inability to develop an indigenous culture, citizenship, the concept of citizenship, which would allow the sense of loyalty of nationhood to develop. Ultimately, I'm afraid that America will discover that Saudi Arabia will go, if not the way of Iran, will become something, be ruled by others quite different than those who rule in Saudi Arabia now, and we'll have to make our peace with that. But for now, to place into their hands these weapons of attack, control, destruction, is really an ultimate act of folly, tempered only by the fact that if we were ever to withdraw suddenly our own mercenaries, our technicians, the Saudis wouldn't know what to do with the equipment that was in place. It couldn't fly, it couldn't be shot, it couldn't be used. Perhaps in a sense that's our ultimate weapon against the oil weapon. If you boycott us, we'll pull away from you. But I seriously doubt that the oil-dependent powers that control so much of the discussion, the personnel in the State Department and elsewhere would ever tolerate that kind of idea. What's in the future? What happens if, as seems likely now, the vote is against the AWACS sale? Will the American Jewish community be blamed? American Jews be accused of disloyalty? The answer is yes. Will it be significant in the social structure in our lives? The answer is probably no. We'll move on today from crisis to crisis so quickly that these crises tend to be forgotten. But yes, we will be blamed. The whole issue has been